I'm writing a book about Pope Francis and Bernard Lonergan, which confuses everybody because it seems that Pope Francis never read Bernard Lonergan, this philosopher, theologian that I focus on in my own studies and teaching. The reason is to try to give support at a deep academic level to the project of Pope Francis. If I can share an image with you, a book publisher in the States that is going to publish my book, I believe, said that fairly soon after the election of Pope Francis, Cardinal Casper spoke to Catholic book publishers saying, look, there's trouble ahead. This Pope is so different that he's going to be criticised, not least by academic right-wing people. So it is incumbent on theologians that agree with Pope Francis, if I might use the term more progressive theologians, to pick up the slack, so to speak, to give an academic defence of what Pope Francis is arguing for more pastorally and more directly. So that's part of what I'm trying to do in this book.
And so are you giving a theological sound basis to what Pope Francis is doing in a pastoral way? But he seems to know what he's about. Yeah. Nonetheless, I mean, he's not stupid.
That's right. So we don't want to dismiss him as being merely pastoral, and even if we're writing a sympathetic academic support for him, because that's one of the ways of rejecting Pope Francis. So it's true. He's very informed theologically and comes from an even more specialised tradition in Argentina that he bought into, of a version of liberation theology, a version of how to receive Vatican II in Latin America. But he was never a professional academic, and the two popes that preceded him were, and they lasted for 35 years. So that's another aspect of what is so new with Pope Francis. It's more normal in the history of the papacy, but it's new for those of us who have lived through those years. So, to try to provide an academic defence of what he's doing.
Because he is being criticised by these terminologies, but the conservative right or the more traditionalists, where some of them in the blogs that they write, it's like they feel he's abandoned official church doctrine, and they're saying things like, you know, we shouldn't really... He has no real authority, and you take some things, and if they fit with tradition, then you accept them, and the rest, as one blogger put it, you would give no more weight to it than you would to your daughtery uncle. Mm. Now, that's the level that we're getting to, so he does need the support. What would you say to bloggers like that and to people who are launching a fairly sustained attack since he's come to power, since he's taken up his role as Pope?
Well, in a sense, my book is written to neutral third parties because there's very little you could ever say to such bloggers that would persuade them. And that comes into my book, actually, to try to understand this phenomenon of opposition. The psychology of it, the academic background to it is fascinating. It might sound a bit off topic, but I'm convinced that exactly this kind of temperature of debate occurred during Vatican II. We're revisiting Vatican II in a strange way. So it's a certain mentality. Central to my book is this notion that comes from Lonergan that the key challenge in theology today is a transition from classical mindedness to historical consciousness. So a classically minded person is somebody who thinks in an abstract form. It's all concepts. The Catholic faith, the Christian faith, has been worked out very nicely. And we have a formula that we can apply, so to speak, from a catechism to any given case in the world where we know what to do. That's the classical mindedness. And it basically got defeated in Vatican II, but it kept up a robust defence in a minority role. The debates in Vatican II were remarkably similar as the blogs today. It's just that they lost those debates, and the documents of Vatican II nearly always went in a different direction that I call historical consciousness. Gaudium et Spes, the Church in the Modern World, is the great example of this, but it is in continuity with all the other documents. It's difficult to explain what is historical consciousness. It's a question of not going for abstract systems, but rather recognizing that we're in process and that there's a whole question of how change occurs in, even in how we understand the truth of Jesus Christ. Change occurs in society. There's this phenomenon of culture that we create, and so the meanings in our culture evolve, and so theology must evolve with that culture. To somebody who is a classicist, that seems like pure relativism. Mm. There seems like no hope to retain objectivity, doctrine, truth in that. I would say, on the other hand, that's partly true. There is a great deal of relativism that goes in this historically conscious philosophy, which is the postmodern culture that we're in. However, certainly I would appeal to Bernard Lonergan and say there is also a way, however, to handle this authentically and to retain a notion of objectivity that emerges in the process and that isn't dependent on these abstract absolute systems.
I know it's a huge debate and we haven't time to get into it now, but I do think the key word there is historical consciousness, because what it is saying is that even a cursory glance back at church history would to some extent raise questions about there being any such thing as just a pure museum-like body of tradition that has never changed and through which, as a filter, we must put every single development. So I think it's very interesting what you're doing. The sense we get from Rome is sometimes in the media is that the Pope is facing a lot of opposition from within. Let's leave the bloggers to one side. Is that true? I mean, we've had the Dubia and, you know, the cardinals who've come out very frankly and spoken out. Is tension increasing there?
I would not say that it's increasing, but that's not necessarily good news, because it was always strong from the beginning of the pontificate of Pope Francis, and he was under no delusion about that. Just to say, I'm towards the end of my book, my manuscript at the moment, so I'm immersed in the biography of Pope Francis, especially leading up to his election as Pope. He himself, as Archbishop of Buenos Aires, was in intense conflict, really, with members of the Curia, who were trying to interfere in the workings of his diocese, let alone in the Episcopal Conference of all Latin America. So he has a long history of recognizing that there is this kind of opposition. Before he was elected, just a few years, the bishops of Latin America came together in a big assembly called a Aparecida in 2007. And they staged a quiet rebellion, frankly, against the era of John Paul II, when this sort of control from the Curia had full approval. So they reasserted themselves. But just after the Aparecida, he started to get worried, Archbishop Bergoglio, that this Curia was still so centralizing, they were going to try to reverse that recent initiative in Latin America. So he never thought he would be Pope. He thought he was too old. But he was interested in a Latin American Pope, somebody else. But he was very much feeling that there's a danger even for Latin America being allowed go in its own direction unless there is a kind of root and branch reform in the Curia. So he came, then he was surprised and felt consoled and able to accept to be Pope. But he came in with a rather clear agenda of reform and a familiarity with the details of what needed reforming. So he went straight into a certain kind of gentle conflict, I would say. He's subtle in his ways, but we're talking about 35 years of curial habit forming and 35 years of bishops' appointments around the world that were directly expected to agree with this. So he's been in a job of reform, and I don't see conflict getting worse now, that really, than in many ways, that it was at least more perhaps in a hidden way from the beginning.